Well, thank you. I thought we had 20 minutes to do this. So if I get cut off at 15, your first question can be, what else did he want to say? So my background is that I trained in pediatrics and then went on to law school. And you might ask, why is a pediatrician interested in death and dying? First of all, the economics of death and dying from a public health standpoint is significant. I'm also, I believe, probably the oldest person in the room. I've had dying parents, and I've reached the age now where friends are beginning to get those chronic illnesses that have been mentioned previously. And I think it's time for me to look at some of the issues that I want to discuss with you today. I have... I got it. Finally. No personal financial relationships to disclose. And I urge you to think about the public health implications of what we're discussing within this talk. For example, in Caroline's talk about falls and post-fall behaviors, there'll be one slide that'll talk a little bit about the issues of healthcare affecting the elderly, and what can we do before that fall happens to prevent the fall? And what can we do to prevent some of those chronic illnesses? And then in Rosanna's statement, the question of advanced directives and what can we do to prepare for those times that we would like to have our decisions accounted for. So in this discussion today, what I'd like to do is go over the aging demographics. I'd like to talk about what I believe elders want, and you'll find out it's not much different probably than what anybody else wants, but it's significant at the time you're making those decisions, have those decisions as you get older and older and are in an existential time of your pending death. And I'd like to look at the bioethical principles. How do we relate to one another as a society? What should we do? And then the myriad of health issues that affect the elderly. I'm a big proponent of the Affordable Care Act, so I'll describe for you what is and is not in the Affordable Care Act and how it's evolving. A little bit about public policy and elderly protections, which also grew out of the Affordable Care Act. And then I'll close with death and dignity, the right to die, personal attitudes, as well as legal, not what the society should do, but what the society says we must do within the laws. And then hopefully a chance for just some very brief final comments. So the demographics are the over 65 population. Right now, 50 million of us, or 15%, slated to grow to 20% by 2050. Critical, and for those of you, if you want to give me a card, I'll be glad to send you this presentation because there's a lot of information I might not be able to get to, but I think it's a good overview, and I learned a lot, certainly, in preparing for it. But what you'll see is there's a 60% increase in the number of people and or 67% actually, from 50 million to 84 million in the next 35 years. Significant change. We're not going to change much. Women overbalance men, and one of the reasons why there are so many women widowed and living longer, with the implications you'll see in terms of financing, of personal finance. 80% of the population today is white. It will drop to 63%. Significant drop and change if you kind of draw your own pie chart. And the Hispanic population will more than double. African American percentage will increase by 50%. Asians will almost double. We are rapidly becoming a nation of change, particularly in this older population, which will spend considerably more on their health care. Today, you've already seen the demographic. We live to almost 80 years old. If we survive to 65, we're going to have another 20 years left in our lives. This was something that I was quite surprised to find out. 20% of males and 13% of females over the age of 65 work. 50% of males working full-time and almost 40% of women full-time. But if you look at the demographic between 65 and 69, 36% of males are still working and a quarter of women are still working. And I leave you with the question of why are they working? They have two choices. They have to work because our economic situation right now in the economy says you better work, because if you don't work, you won't have the resources to live those extra 20 years. Or is it by choice? The long-term policy implications of this are what kinds of decisions are going to be made in terms of Social Security and some of our additional policies toward the aging if people have to work or do work, and how will our what kinds of changes will occur in our policies once that data is known by our lawmakers. These are what I believe elders want: health, independence, security, respect, and love. It's consistent with the bioethical principles I'll tell you about in a moment. What do we mean by that? Health, a long, healthy, happy life, free from physical pain and mental disabilities. I think that's the critical aspect. As people reach the end of life, they don't want to be in pain, and their families certainly would like to see them where they can recognize. You'll remember Dr. Hrabowski's story about his mother at the beginning. I have a similar story when my mother didn't recognize me either. Referred to me as a nice young man, she used to have a son who behaved like that. Her final words to me. Independence, the elderly would like to make, and this is in advance, their own decisions regarding their health care and the protection of their financing, because they'd like to be able to live in their own home. They'd like to be safe and protected, and they want to be listened to and treated with dignity, as has been mentioned previously. And I think of the issue of love, and you'll see that it'll be a little more detailed. Saying goodbye to their family members and friends, I think consistent with their faith. And different people with different faiths have different ideas about afterlife, and they just want to be able to die on their terms. So that's a good segue. If you believe in what I posit that elders would like, and you can think of yourself someday being in that position, then this next series of comments will be: what can we expect against those values that we hold dear and we're looking for in terms of ethical principles? What we should expect from a society, how we should behave, but not necessarily how we have to behave. Real difference between ethics and law. And autonomy is the right to self-determination. You heard that earlier. At the time of death, we want to be in control. We want to guide that. We want to guide that ship. Beneficence is the duty to do good, a duty, social responsibility to do good. Non-maleficence is the duty to prevent harm. And duties in the law have a different perspective, because that means you must do. A duty in ethics is a moral obligation. So it's this is what you should do, and it's very clear that you should do good. And justice, I think there's a good overlap between the law and ethics, is the duty to act with fairness and equity, due process, and treating everybody similarly. I think the most important ethical principle from this standpoint is autonomy. In public health area, I'd like to, if you're treating a physician as Maria is, we all deal with informed consent issues. We are obligated to explain to our patients all of the consequences on all of the benefits of a decision that of a medical treatment, and we I think have an obligation to make sure that they understand that, and then they consent to something that they understand. As we get older, this notion of advanced directives very complex, but it defines our healthcare preferences in advance of our going into the hospital. It identifies, it's also called a durable power of attorney or living will. What are the identification of surrogates, who can act for us, and what are the end of life decisions that we'd like acted on us? And finally, privacy issue. What happens though, in terms of actual impact is we have impaired cognition. We can't function. We may desire to refuse treatment. We request that life-sustaining treatment be withdrawn. What actually happens in the society? There are two cases, the Quinlan decision in 1976, where there was a right to privacy established, and it allowed the refusal of unwanted interventions for Karen Quinlan. The Cruzan decision was a federal decision in 1990. It affirmed the right of competent patients to refuse unwanted medical treatments, but it also allowed the state of Missouri to come in and require a higher standard because they had rights too to protect their citizenry. And so there, they started with a clear and convincing evidence that that the person wanted it. And so we're left with evolving law in that area. From a public health perspective, I would say that when you're for yourself, when you go home, draw up your advance directives to protect yourself and your family members, and note that 75% of Americans don't have an advance directive today. So as you meet, and it's something that we can advocate for. Very briefly, the other, I'll leave you a chance to just look at this, the other ethical principles. Remember, if you give me a card, I'll be glad to send this to you. Do no harm and justice. Treat all individuals fairly and equitably, and apply the standard of care to everyone. Just because you're older, if you are healthy and you're not, you're one of the 55% who is a healthy and you don't have three or four chronic illnesses, you could be treated like a 45-year-old and shouldn't have treatments withheld. But then we face the medical system. When I graduated medical school, most of us took the Hippocratic Oath, and in that, there's the notion of do no harm. So the non-maleficence is what we should do as doctors. And so does that mean that the healthcare system is going to apply those ethical benefits to you? Well, as you know, we have a curative healthcare system. Physicians are trained to treat patients, to cure patients, and dying in this slide is prohibited. So as we get older, let's take a brief look at what kinds of health issues impact the elderly. Hubie Blake, who was 96 years old when he passed away, said, if I knew I was going to live this long, I'd take better care of myself. And I think you're never too young to start reflecting on what Hubie said. Start taking better care of yourself. These are the illnesses that affect the elderly. Heart disease and stroke, leading killer, cancer, respiratory disease. 50% of the elderly, this is over 65, and you can imagine as we age out and become 75 and 85, they get even higher. 51% are arthritic. 5 million adults have Alzheimer's disease, and that's going to grow the definition. And as we learn more about it, and as we make more diagnoses, osteoporosis. If you fall, the likelihood of breaking a bone, having a hip fracture, and then having subsequent problems that you're flat on your back. The vaccines for flu and pneumonia are available. They're now also paid for by the Affordable Care Act. 30% of ER visits and 14% of those visits are as a result of falls. And 20% of people have substance abuse. So the integration of our behavioral health care system with our physical health care system is critical. 40% of people are obese. That's now. You can imagine what it's going to be like in 5 or 10 years. 15% of the population are depressed, treatable. And I was surprised that a quarter of our older population have no teeth. And we started a geriatric dental program when I was in Arlington 35 years ago. So in the Affordable Care Act, senior benefits, we provide preventive care and wellness visits without coinsurance or deductibles. The donut hole, that period when you have out-of-pocket payments, is gradually contracting. We have care coordination, and these are the truth about the Affordable Care Act. They also contained originally, in its original writing, voluntary counseling for Medicare patients about wills and end-of-life options was included, but it was canceled and taken out of the bill because there was political misrepresentation, as you'll remember. The death panels came in and they were going to throw grandma over the cliff. But I can tell you, last Friday, in the new Medicare physician fee schedule beginning in 2016, that has been restored. Two codes to pay physicians to provide end-of-life counseling. There's also Elder Justice Act in Affordable Care Act. There are additional protections to improve staffing and protect you in the nursing home. And the Dodd-Frank bill allows for protection from sexual exploitation and abuse and neglect. Let me just give you a couple of I'll give you a couple of poems, and then I'll cut. And remember, your first question could be, how much more did he plan to say in 5 minutes? Emily Dickinson looks, she does not fear death. In The Chariot, she says, death is looked upon as being a kind person. She allows death to come in the carriage with her, and immortality, the afterlife. She's not fearful of death. On the other hand, Edgar Allan Poe, who wrote this poem, had a pretty dark side to begin with, but this poem was written shortly after his wife, his young wife, passed away. And you can see some of the words in that poem. He doesn't accept death the way the prior poet did, and he used gray and tombstone, thine hour of secrecy. And Woody Allen, when he looked at his own mortality, he didn't want people to look at it and think about it in terms of the movies that he wrote or the books that he wrote. He really wanted to achieve immortality by just not dying. Do I have a couple more minutes, or you want?
What we could do is break for questions, and people can, ask you the questions
you just
said.
Okay. Thank you so much for your question. Your unanticipated, unrequested, but begged for.
Question is,
I am shameless, absolutely shameless. These are the attitudes toward death in the various religions, and I leave it to you. These are the five major religions, and you know, right now we're looking at the Western Hemisphere and Islam. Both, I think that it crosses over. You begin to see the differences in attitudes, and only in Confucianism is it totally not addressed, and it varies in Judaism. The next question that someone could ask me about is, what does the law actually say?
What does the law?
I am so glad that there are other people here. And again, glad to send that out to you all. So, in answer to your question, what does the law say? Supreme Court decision in 1997. This case was trying to overturn a current statute in Washington that banned assisted suicide. So the doctors came in and wanted to allow to have a patient be allowed to pass away, and the Supreme Court said that this was not a fundamental liberty interest. There was no protection of a right to assisted suicide, and there was a compelling state interest to preserve human life and to protect the mentally ill and disabled. And they expressly were concerned about not having a pathway to euthanasia. This statute, though, which was clear, in which our state attorney general, I had a conversation as I was preparing this discussion, he said, that's going to prevent you from your overall premise in your last statement, which is, I want the Supreme Court to end up ultimately with a tipping point, as in the AIDS, our recent right to gay marriage issue with enough states. Yesterday at this conference, one of the presenters in a small group said that my own attorney general misread this case, and that the dicta, the little small print in the decision, in the opinion, said that if there are sufficient numbers of states, history and tradition, then you can, the Supreme Court can change this decision into a fundamental. There's a Gonzales versus Oregon, the latest Supreme Court decision supporting the Death with Dignity Act in I won't go through all the details of this, but suffice it to say that that Oregon was supported, and what happened was, in both of these cases, the Supreme Court cases ended up supporting the state position. So usually, and you're going to have look, you can look at the complexion of the Supreme Court and states' rights, so how the state words its laws. We currently have four states that have end-of-life support. Washington, after that first Supreme Court decision, ended up passing a Death with Dignity Act, overturning its previous law that prevented it. In 1997 to 2008, Washington changed. And just last month, California signed into law its Death with Dignity, and the New Mexico Court of Appeals overturned its Death with Dignity statute, but it could go to their Supreme Court.
Can you say one more question about the law?
There's still more.
I have a comment with regard to the question. My name is Ruben Becker. I'm actually a big rabbi, and I have written a book on the topic called Variety Parents Secret. What I'd like to just share is that in the Orthodox Jewish practice, there are certain traditions that are go in sometimes in conflict with cognitive care practice. And there was an advanced directive that we established in the field that is not exactly the same that is available online. The reason for that is that motivated by our tradition of respect for not encouraging any death, so that it allows for someone to call a rabbi or some other spiritual advisor prior to signing the DNR and this one for the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just
want
to clarify, you made a comment about palliative care, maybe not in alignment with palliative care. And I just want to state that palliative medicine, in my view, palliative medicine is really to align the complex world of healthcare we have with patients and families' needs and wishes. And that's not necessarily, but I often get the words they're on palliative or they're getting the DNR. And that oversimplifies it. We're dealing with so many decisions in healthcare, and really the goal is to align and focus on quality of life, and that may be symptom management.
Well, to find out how to cure it, but I also encourage points of having the rest of it. So if you do not have that, then the ethics committee will make their own decisions, and they might be conscious of the family's interest.
In deference to that comment, you'll recall an earlier slide which mentioned love. We want to die on our own terms, consistent with our own faith. And the law may not recognize what you're suggesting, but it should. The ethical side is, I should be able to make my decision. If I'm an Orthodox Jew, I might want to do one thing. If I'm a Reformed Jew, I might want to do something else. And in the state of Indiana, yesterday I learned that you can have a religious advisor. Everybody's kind of has equal weight in being a final decision maker, which creates a very complex situation in Indiana. But your spiritual advisor, if you are unfriended, or you have no relatives, no friends, and you're there, a spiritual advisor can make that decision for you.
Good question. So it wasn't by number, it was on a scale, so falling every week. Some people have fallen every week among the 130 people. But it was a few, so that's why I grouped one fall only and more than a fall. But for the interviews, so people have fallen, I didn't talk about the interviews, but people have fallen up to three times in the last 6 months. I'm guessing it could be the same.
And people who have fallen more frequently, how did that affect the number of the decisions that they decided to implement or change?
Right. We didn't really look at that, but I'm hypothesizing that they may have made more decisions after the fall, so more changes, but it always depends on the fall and on the severity of the fall, too, whether they make more medical decisions or if they can make corrective or social care decisions.
One question. This is a question for everybody who's dealing with samples. And my question is, was there any effect of dementia? Did you exclude people who had any history of dementia, or are they incorporated in this sample at all?
For our survey, we informally assessed any cognitive impairments, but we didn't use like the MoCA instruments. So if they could, well, with the retirement communities, we asked staff and they informally assessed by knowing the participants, knowing if there were any changes in the participants. On my end, whenever I was meeting or screening participants from non-institutional homes, I asked them a lot of questions just to track whether they could explain the fall and the decisions they made. So it was an informal assessment, but for future research, we would want to include an actual measure of cognitive impairment.
I just want to make a comment on our population of advanced illness. The team that chose to work with the population of dementia was very challenging to identify that population because everybody being admitted to the hospitals are not being admitted for dementia. They're largely half the 50% of the population in the hospital has dementia, but they're admitted for UTI, a fall, right? That's the acute illness they're being treated with, so it's not highlighted as a problem, and yet it impacts the care anywhere across the hospital system. So they had to find other ways to identify it, and so it's challenging.
I have a question. So, asking them to define the top change, was that in terms of what was the most difficult or what was the most important?
The most important for them, yeah, among the changes they had listed on our survey.
Do we have time to take questions for Dr. Carney next? I'm sorry. I have a question. You mentioned, first of all, the spring program that you described, and you mentioned about collecting data on people that are involved in the program. Do you have any plans to collect information on controls, and how do you plan to evaluate the assessment?
This is strictly a quality improvement process throughout the health system. There are individuals that are considering IRB studies related to their project, but I'm not involved necessarily in that. And the data that we're collecting is really on the goals of the discussion, how many are being done, who's involved, how are they documenting it, to see the impact.
And I want to real quick comment to help you with doing evaluations, which is such an important thing that you're doing as a great
evaluation. And another additional response that came out of this large project was the health system hospital personnel are challenged that no one's having these discussions ahead of time. So we are rolling out what we're calling a chat program, conversations in health and treatment, and partnering with community organizations to educate about holding conversations when you're healthy and not in the time of crisis. So that's a project that came out of this as well.
And do you share your information with any other states or?
We're just in the data collection. We're letting people know in forums like this that we are involved in this quality improvement project. We've submitted to IHI and now APHA, and we hope with the data collection we'll be able to show that.
Question for the staff? You described that the people that you talked to were from two different healthcare organizations, both advanced care specializations, but the demographics of their sample were quite different from the Northern California organization and the Southern California organization. Just wondering if you saw some differences you could speak to.
Sure, I did share that. So that's Dr. Patty, which is part of the project center. So she had a lot more information about the project, but so we did sample we had two different samples and they were very diverse. The one from the Northern California was predominantly white, monolingual, U.S. born, and with a high level of education, and the one from Southern California was predominantly minority, mixed of monolingual Spanish and Southern English, and less than a high school education. So they're very diverse. However, we were just trying to look at all the similarities across both of them. Because the differences, there are a lot of differences in terms of language, in terms of even though their healthcare organizations were integrated and they were geriatric focused, one was a PACE model, the other one was not. The one was primary care provider focused, and the other one was more adult day health care and social work. And so even though the dynamics are a little bit different, but what we were trying to look was the similarities in it. What we reported was, even though they're contextually different from one another, everybody kind of wants the same thing. So that's kind of what we wanted to focus
those are the differences.
Hi, you mentioned that the longitudinal aspect of the study was a strength, but I'm wondering if you could talk about what additionally you gained in terms of knowledge from doing the interview longitudinally versus just doing a project.
Sure. So it gave us, we did three of them, and the first one helped us to establish rapport and build trust within them with the participant. By time two and time three, we were able to capture some of the decision-making processes. So for instance, there was one individual who at time one had told us, we were able to capture more of the preference-based decision-making, not this crisis-based one. Although we did have some individuals in crisis, we didn't probe around those areas. One individual had told us, I am never going to move from here. By time two, he said, I'm moving because my health is being threatened by members of the community who are threatening me and my health is suffering. By time three, he had forgotten what he had told me in time two because he had already resolved that issue. So he had to move forward. We were able to capture that process. So that's just one example. Another example of a lady who her doctor was really trying to get her to I'm not an MD, but weight loss surgery, which is a very heavy stick. Right. And she was adamantly refused to have any conversations about that. By time two, she had started to think about it. We always kind of probe around that. And by time three, she had decided she was going to go ahead and do it. So it allowed us to kind of look at the, right. How many times did doctors bring it up? What conversations did they have? Did you include any family members? And did you, what kind of discussions did you have? So it allowed us to probe around that specific decision.
We can take one more question
from
Chicago. All right, well, this has been a great session. Thank you again to the presenters and the